By popular consensus, the seer has voted to study Megillas, study Megillas Esther this week. Okay, hopefully we'll have a better understanding of the Megillah. It's always good to study. I think that Purim is one of those days where we don't spend enough time studying Megillah and focusing on what it's all about. There's a lot of things to talk about in Megillas Esther, so we won't have time to cover nearly enough of them, but nonetheless, we'll get through what we can. Says one of the themes of Purim is the idea of Hester Panim. In fact, if you look in the Megillah, if you look in the Torah, the Gemara says, how do you know Esther min HaTorah minayin? Where is the Makor? This is the Gemara in Megillah, if I recall. Where is there a reference to Esther in the Torah? So the Gemara says, Anochi Asher Asir et Panai Mehem. Even the idea of Esther's name, the word Esther comes from, what does the word Esther mean? He Hadassah, her name was really Hadassah. So Esther, the whole Megillah of Esther is the story of Hester Panim, of God's hidden hand. And this is one of the primary themes of Megillah's Esther. How do we know? What do we see from the Megillah of God's hidden hand? What? Nothing could happen without God. So what's specific about Esther? What is omitted? What famous thing is omitted from the Megillah? Right, Shem Hashem. God's name is omitted. It doesn't appear in the Megillah.
Is there a special reason for that?
What's that?
Is there a special
Absolutely, this is the reason. Because the Megillah, the whole point of reading the Megillah is, someone could read the story and say, very interesting story. Imagine such a chain of events taking place. Who would have guessed? One in a million. You know, the very person, isn't it unbelievable? The king, he just decides all of a sudden to get rid of his wife, and then he picks this other girl, and at the same time, whoever would have thought, you know, it's very easy for someone to have read this story and said, it's a fantastic series of coincidences, but it's nothing out of the ordinary, nothing supernatural. And interestingly enough, this is what we believe, obviously, that the story of Esther is a story of the understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu leads. God does guide us, I would say. That's the word I would use. God does sort of lead the Jewish people, but in a hidden hand with Hester upon him. And I think that that's something. First of all, Esther is the first story in the Tanakh. Is it the first story? Because when did Daniel happen? I think it is. Right. Esther is the first story in Tanakh that happens in the Galus. Because what happens? You have to know a little bit of a Jewish history. First, there was the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, right? And the story of Esther is somewhere after that. It's not clear how many years after that, but it's in Persia, right? Haras u'Madai, the Galus of Persia. And then the Megillas Esther happens. Then the story of Esther happens. Okay? And there's all these different subtexts and contexts of what's going on. But nonetheless, it's the first story of the Jews in the Galus. So when we were in Eretz Yisrael, when we had Eretz Yisrael, and when we had the Beis HaMikdash, there was always some way of communicating with God. How did we communicate with God, especially during the times of the Bais Rishon, the first temple? How do we communicate with God? Well, we communicate with God through Tefillah. How did He communicate with us? Again, this is pretty simple. During the times of the Beis HaMikdash, up to the end of the Bais Rishon, how does God communicate with the Jewish people? Right, very good. The Nevi'im, you have Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, you know. All these Nevi'im, they're basically telling us God wants you to do this, God wants you to do that. As soon as Galus comes, over. No more direct communication. That's what we live with today. You know, if only we would have a Navi come and tell us, well, what's the problem? What are the Jewish people doing wrong? How would we keep the land of Israel? You know, we think it would be simple. Except God knows what would happen. If the Navi would come and say, God wants you to do this, what would we say? Well, very nice, but, you know, nice job. Good rabbi, that's very good, but, you know, this is the real world. We can't do it. It's not so easy. Which is why HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't send Nevi'im. You know, you can only send Nevi'im if people are going to listen to them. But afterwards, that's gone. So the story of Megillas Esther really is the story of the Jewish people in exile. And it's a very troubling story. Let's see. So one thing you also notice about Megillas Esther is it's very verbose. You can't hang on every word. There's a lot of extra stuff in there. And it's not because it's not the Torah. It was written by Mordechai. It was accepted by Chazal into the canon, into Tanakh. But it's got a lot of extra information that's there for a reason. Vayibim Achashverosh, it was in the times of Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh HaMolech Mehodu Be'atush Sheva Az Ve'asrim U'meya Medina. Right? He was king from Hodu until Kus. Bayamim Hahem Kisheves HaMelech Achashverosh Al Kisei Malchut Tel Asher B'Shushan Habibah. In those days, when the king Achashverosh sat on his throne in Shushan, Bishnat Shalosh L'Malko, and during the third year of his reign, Asa Mishteh L'Chol Sarav Ve'Avadav. He made a party for all of his ministers. Chel Paras Umadai HaPartamim V'Sarei HaMedinot L'Fanav. Who? The nobles and princes, and also the army of Persia and Media. Chel Paras Umadai. See, there's, when you learn Megillas Esther, there's a number of ways to learn it. One of the ways to learn it, I think I've done this before, I think I did it on Shabbosim, is to try to understand historically what's really going on. Why in the world would a king, in the third year of his reign, have a big party for all of his ministers and nobles, plus the entire army?
Maybe he wants to show that he's now permanently fixed as the king.
Correct, but why invite just the army?
They just want a war or something?
What?
They just want a war.
Or they're planning on a war.
War.
Right, planning a war. Right, when they say party, see, the Megillah is written from a Jewish perspective. And a lot of important historical details, or details that we would think are important, are left out. It's kind of vague. Mordechai, the king Achashverosh had a party. Okay. Who is it for? Chel Paras and Madai, the army? Fine. Pasuk Dalin. Behar Oso es Osher Kavod Malchuso. When he showed the wealth of his kingdom. Es Yikar Tiferes Gedulato. And the beauty of his majesty. Yamim Rabim Shmonim Umaas Yom. It was 180 days. So now what's 180 days is not a coincidence.
What do the 180 days tell you? I'm just looking for the book of Midrash on Megillas Esther that I cannot find right now. Because I've got the Midrash on Megillas Esther. Let me see, hold on 1 second. What
could
you give you 180 days? How many days
is 6 months? Right? So what would take 6 months is a chunk. Meaning it was obviously not one of these haphazard meetings. It was obviously planned meetings. When you say 180 days, that tells you that that's something that's significant. When you see that, it should send up red flags. Okay, 1 second. What's he doing showing off Osher Kvod Malchuto? So you guys don't have Rashi. 1 second. Let me see if I can find the Rashi. Okay, let's see what he shows. Ubimlo'ot ha'yamim ha'ela. Okay, when these days finished, asa ha'melech chol ha'am ha'nimtzaim b'shushan ha'bira. So the king made a party. Migadol bi'akatam mishteh shivat yamim v'chatzar ginat bitan ha'melech. So he made a party for 7 days. At the end of the 180-day meeting, he made another party. Why? What's he there to celebrate? Right, meaning in the Megillah, he is portrayed as just being a drunk. Achashverosh. But he isn't just a drunk. He's a drunk who also has an agenda. Okay, he conquers 127 countries. How many countries are there in the world? Anybody know? How many countries are there in the world?
As of now?
At that time. I think there were 128.
All but one.
Right. See, that's the funny thing about having all but one. If you have all but one, that last one always gets to you. Right? This is an interesting theme in the Megillah. It's interesting. Historically, they say that he only didn't control one island. Anybody know what island?
That bothered you.
Yeah. Okay, what island? Who was the next major power to take over? The island of Crete, I think, which is really where the Greeks come from. Right? And historically, if I recall correctly, I'm just doing this off the top of my head. So you have 127, so you've got to control the whole world. Right? So what do you have to have? You have a meeting. You have your army come in, and you discuss this, right? And you figure out, you know, what's the best way of attacking. You're going to have that attack, and you're going to control 100. You're going to make it not 127, but you're going to hopefully control 128. right? But it's interesting. Somebody else in the Megillah also can't stand that last one. Who else in the Megillah?
Solomon.
Oh, right. When you need to have everything. People have spent their lives, have ruined their lives, trying to achieve everything when they had almost everything. You know, and these are two good examples. As we're going to see, well, we're not going to see, it doesn't really become clear what happens, but Ahasuerus does not win his battle. If that's the Ahasuerus that we're thinking of. And Haman, obviously, if Haman would have let things go, if Haman would have ignored Mordechai and let things go along and not hatched his whole plan, what would have happened to Haman in the end? He would have grown in power and stature to the point where he would have been inconquerable. But his own impatience, his own inability to let things sort of lie, his own need to have everything, to have everyone bow down to him, have everyone be subservient to him, ultimately brings about his own downfall. Right? And it's a very interesting and important lesson that there, that, you know, sometimes we, you know, when you accomplish so much, people measure their accomplishments in more of what they don't have than what they do have. And that's a terrible thing. You know, you see it sometimes, not very often, you see it sometimes. You know, people who are...
want too much.
Not just want too much. Yeah,
never happy.
Right.
Satisfied.
Never satisfied because they look more at what they don't have, what they would like to have, as opposed to what they do have. And I think that's something that we all have a challenge with, to be honest with you. You know, like, we just, put our floor in the dining room. Because I had this, anybody's ever been in my dining room? You've been in my dining room, right? So I had this gross carpet. Because the people before us, they used it as a den. They didn't use it as a dining room. So it always irked me. So as soon as you do the floor, and it's nice, and we painted.
Now you look at
the walls. I actually painted on Sunday, because it was easier to paint. But as soon as you do one thing, you know, what?
Never.
You know, like you do the, so then we're looking at the kitchen. Oh, hey, anybody ever do a kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
You did your kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you can't even start without just slapping down at, you know, 15 grand. That's cheap. That's nothing, right? You can't even start. So, like, well, when does it end? You know, well, if I do that, then it doesn't pay to do that. And it doesn't. If I do that, then it doesn't pay to do that. It's a very hard, challenging question. What, you know, when do you say...
It's enough.
Well, not just enough, but I need it as opposed to what I want. You know, when do you say that? It's a very hard thing.
When do you start keeping up with the Joneses?
Yeah, but I don't even look at that. I'm not trying to keep up with... Maybe I am. I don't know. You know?
No, when you are a mature person, then you can say no. My husband never had this yet.
What, Dad? Do the kitchen?
Yeah. No.
Even for you? Like, you know, the kitchen... Our kitchen was not built for milchuts and fleishiks. There's not enough room for all the pots. It's true. You know, we have a lot of stuff. We serve a lot of guests. We have, there's not enough room for all of that stuff. So is that a yetzer? Is that a taiva?
In a way, yes.
I agree with you.
Yes.
Is it a legitimate taiva?
Most probably.
I don't know. So that's something I have to be honest with you. That's something I struggle with. You know, I also struggle with the more you invest in a place, the more you're settling down. Not that I want to move to another place to be a rabbi somewhere else, but, you know, If you preach Aliyah, you preach Aliyah, we belong in Eretz Yisrael, so it's hard to invest thousands and thousands of dollars in a house here. You don't get it back. It doesn't. You know what I'm saying? It's just hard. It's a challenge. Anyway.
Yeah, but you know, when you see these young couples, they buy a house.
Yeah.
And in that house, many, many full people have lived there.
Right.
Have lived the kosher life.
And now all of a sudden.
All of a sudden, this is the kosher life. Then all of a sudden, before we move in, if you don't do it now, we will never do it. And they get into debt, and their parents get into debt, and it's just without a
circle.
Yeah. You can make it so urgent that you just have to do it this month.
So we don't have to do it. I mean, you know, I agree with that. And, you know, I try to do some of it myself. I actually enjoy doing that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, so there are some things, if you've ever gone to my living room, so when we bought the house, they had a white carpet. So the carpet is such that it becomes stained. I don't know. When the carpet goes bad, it can get stained right away, and you can't clean it out. So in the middle of this white carpet, there's a blotch about this size that's black. So yeah, right. In the middle of the carpet. Right in the middle of the room. You know what I'm talking about. You saw my carpet.
Put a little No,
you can't. So, you know, that, to me, that's an issue of cleanliness. It was always an issue of cleanliness to me. It just drove me, you know, so we're replacing the carpet. But, that, you know, otherwise, there is no end. There's always something else you can do, something else you'd like to do, something more. It's a big challenge. So, you know. And what does Ahasuerus really care about? Ahasuerus? Let's look. Chor karpasit techeles. Achuz bechevle boots ve'argaman. Like, what did he show? It was a show. What did he want to show? Hangings of fine white cotton, blue wool. Aglule kesa ve'amudei sheish, held with cords of fine linen and purple wools upon silver rods and marble pillars. Mitos zahav v'chesef al-ritzpat bahat v'sheish v'dar v'selchares. The couches of gold were silver and a pavement of green and white and shell and onyx and marble. By the way, it's just interesting to me. It's a very important social comment. This is not impressive to us. Ahasuerus' home, and I say this without any exaggeration whatsoever, was not as nice as our homes.
It was gaudy.
No. You're thinking hangings of fine white cotton, blue wool. Maybe the materials were better, but our homes, with carpeting, and hardwoods, and you know, and drapes and wallpaperings. You have to think about it. Our homes today are nicer than Ahasuerus' home as described here. Okay, we might not have had actual gold cups. Anybody here have silver cups?
Sure.
You have fine china?
Mm-hmm.
You have glassware? Ahasuerus never had glassware. Not the kind you could see through. So it is important to note and to be aware of, okay, you might not have the actual diamonds or whatever, but our homes physically are nicer. By far. And interestingly enough, might even have been larger.
Than the palace?
Why not? How big do you think they could build back then? You're not talking about modern technology. You're not talking about, you know, construction and engineering and architecture. So my home, probably not. I mean, it's an oak podcast. You take some of those, you know, take a nice house in Southfield. I know, we all know some people who have just built homes in Oak Park, right? You think Ahasuerus' home was 3,500 square feet? Maybe it was because he had all the women in the harem. But aside from that, impossible. So it's just important to know.
But wasn't it larger than the other people's homes?
Oh, yeah, much big time. They had nothing. People had gornish. They lived in, you know, you ever see those shanty towns, you know, in India or Bangladesh or whatever? People couldn't afford anything. There was no way. So this idea of having this big city, it's just... Who had hand-woven hangings? Okay, do you have patterns on your wall?
No. But
you don't have patterns on your wall?
Yes, wallpaper.
Yeah.
You do. Very good. Is it colorful?
No, I don't have patterns on my wall.
I do.
White, just plain white wallpaper on my wall.
What, and there's no designs etched into it?
Mm-hmm.
I do. We all do. Do you have a woven floor covering?
A carpet. Do you have a carpet?
Sure.
Sure. Do you have colorful, you know, do you have pictures on your walls?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nice pictures, right? Beautiful pictures. So just think about the things that we're accustomed to. Like, for example, Ahasuerus didn't have air conditioning.
But he had people
fans. Do you know what he would have given to have air conditioning? In the middle of Persia?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the middle of the summertime, you know what the weather is in Iraq in the summertime? 115 degrees, 116 degrees. So maybe in the shade it's 85 or 90. Just think about, I'm sorry, the things that we take for granted. When Ahasuerus needed to go to the bathroom, he also had to go outside, even though he was the king of Persia. Well, maybe he didn't, but whatever. Why? Ahasuerus wanted a glass of water. Ahasuerus couldn't imagine a shower, a hot shower.
But he had baths and all these fine spices.
Good, a shower whenever he wants. If Ahasuerus wanted a shower, he wanted a bath, what would they have to do?
They'd have to fill up.
They'd have to boil up the water. They'd have to fill up the pots. They'd have to fill up the thing, you know? That was the whole thing. That was what's so significant about his wives, that they had all these things. You know, nowadays, you think it's so impressive to be spiced every day? Who among us doesn't take a sweet-smelling soap and wash our hair and smell nice? That's the way he wanted his ladies to smell good. Because everybody else stank.
Especially after drinking for 100 years.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Drinking gold cups. Rechelim nichelim shonim. No two goblets were alike. Now, it's interesting. Interesting, you know what the Midrash says about that line. Rechelim nichelim shonim. Anybody know? No, you never heard this Midrash? Very famous Midrash. We read this, I'll read it to you like we read it in the Megillah. V'hashkos v'chlei zahav v'chelim nichelim shonim. We all of a sudden read Echatra.
Yeah.
Why do we recognize that?
Yeah.
Why do we do that?
Because they stole it from
the Midrash. You know the Midrash, very good. Mm-hmm. Right, the Midrash says that these kelim were taken from the Beis HaMikdash. Why the Beis HaMikdash? Because according to the Midrash, this is interesting, by the way, 127, and he wants to conquer 128. What does it mean when you control the whole world? To say that I rule the entire world. I am the king. I am the king of everything.
Everything belongs
to me. Very good. Think about it in another dimension. Who controls everything? God. Right. So what are you doing when you're saying b'chelim, b'chelim shonim?
Pretending to be God.
Correct. Correct. You're saying not necessarily I'm a god, but there is no overarching God. The thing that always is the needle in the side of the nations, that the reason why we bother the nations of the world so much, why do they hate us so much? Why do they hate you so much? What are they jealous of? Jealous of us? For what? For most of history, we were nothing. We were garnished. We were just trying to eke out a living. We were trying to live our own lives and leave them alone. If if you'd ask the Jews, tell you what, we'll leave you alone, you leave us alone. But we don't go proselytizing to people.
No, but they look at us and they see that how different they are.
And therefore, so what does that bother them?
So they're jealous?
No, they're not jealous. They're not jealous. What irks them so much is we remind them that we still believe that there is an overarching and all-powerful God in the world. And our very existence, our presence, is always that needle in their side. That you're not in control. That the bottom line is, here's the people that are living their lives to try to teach you. You're not in control. You can't. You don't dominate or control your own life. You don't really control your own destiny. And that there's an all-powerful being that's in charge of you. And it's not...
But
yeah.
Islam, do they not believe the same thing?
Islam never really had such a big problem with Jews. Muhammad did at the end, but for many, many years, Islam didn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you found very prosperous Jewish communities in all these Islamic countries. When did the Muslims really start to hate us? I mean, really, really start to hate us? You know? And really, when Israel came about. When the battle grew for for Israel. So Muhammad was very upset that they didn't accept him as a prophet. So he was very anti-Jewish. But Islam per se is not necessarily anti-Jewish because we both believe in the same thing. Be'ikaron. They really do. So comes L'Achashverosh, the Midrash, according to the Midrash, this party, the party that was going to celebrate the conquering of the world, was also a party to show what? The Beis HaMikdash era, the Beis HaMikdash is over.
And he's the all-powerful.
Right. He's the all-powerful, and the era of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is over. The Jewish people abandoned the land of Israel. They lost God, and there is no longer an all-powerful being. Because they're no longer in Israel anymore, and that was the problem. So now you understand who came to this meeting, who came to this party. Everyone in Shushan HaBira. Including. In fact, the Gemara says, one of the opinions is, why were the Jewish people chay of Kalia? Why did they merit the punishment that they celebrated that they were going to be destroyed on Purim? Oh, for the lunch. Thank you.
Would you repeat that last question?
Why were the Jewish people, what did we do so bad? What did we do that was so terrible that merited that we, that we would be destroyed by Haman.
Because we believe this guy was over us and not Hashem.
Well, I don't know if we believed it, but we went along with it. Meaning, so one of the opinions of the Gemara is because they participated on Ahasuerus' party.
Yeah.
She'll say, big deal, you know, at face value, so what? So you know what, they were over on a Gzeirah de Rabbanon that they shouldn't drink, you know, with Goyim? You want to tell me they ate non-kosher? So because a bunch of Jews in Shushan ate non-kosher, that's why the whole Jewish people would have to be destroyed? So if you really want to understand that Midrash, what you have to understand is, no, what was the significance of that party? Even if the Jews didn't think it was significant in that way, in Achashverosh's mind, what was it all about? There is no more Jewish people. There is no more HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is no more Beis HaMikdash. Drink from this cup. You know why this cup? I stole it from the Beis HaMikdash, but it's no really different than anything else. There's nothing special about that cup. So when the Jews can go to that party, when the Jewish people can celebrate with that party and participate in such an idea, then you know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says? You know what God says? Well, then there's no need for Jewish people anymore. Because if you're not going to declare my existence and my dominion in the world, then who needs you?
They may not even have been conscious of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they weren't, that's also a lacking. Because the point is they should be conscious of it. That's what a Jew's role in the world is. And that's what, to be honest with you, frightened me very much today.
Same thing.
It frightened me very much today. Forget the whole the Yashka thing. You know, there's an issue that was in the Jewish news last week about gay marriage. So a rabbi wrote how because of civil rights, we should really, as Jews, support gay marriage. And he wrote, he said, I know no Orthodox rabbi will ever do such a thing. Fine, but that's the Orthodox. But we as Jews, we believe in civil rights. It's very interesting. I love how they do this. We believe in the Torah, it says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha.
Sure.
You know? So I don't like that vayikra, I take this vayikra. V'ahavta l'reacha, zeklau gadol v'torah. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. When a Jew says, it's more important to me to be like everybody else, I identify more with being American than I identify with being Jewish. And I think the Kadosh Baruch Hu looks at us and says, that's not a Yid. That's not Judaism. That's not Jewishness.
Can you step back and see what we have?
So here's the problem. Do you think there weren't shuls in the time of Mordechai and Esther?
Pardon?
Do you think there weren't shuls in Persia and Shushan? Do you think there wasn't a young Israel of Shushan? I mean, I'm not being facetious. After the Churban, Mordechai was the only guy around that was firm. He was the only guy that was upset. You think there weren't other Jews that didn't go to the party, that would never step foot in an Ahasuerus' thing? Ahasuerus' celebration. And they said, no, the Jewish... You think there weren't that?
Most probably there were.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what percentage?
Very little.
What? 5%
or
10? 5 or 10%, would you say? Maybe. Let's say 10% of the Jews didn't go.
Yeah.
Would Chazal still condemn the Jews if the Jews went? If 90% went?
I think so.
They probably would. Okay. So now.
I think back of Germany in the 1900s.
Yeah. What percentage of the Jews were from in Germany?
Oh my goodness. Small.
Yeah?
Well, there was a big difference between northern and southern.
Uh-huh.
Southern Jews were much more traditional.
Yeah? Because they were closer to Poland also. Yeah.
No.
I think so. Germany bordered on Poland, correct?
Yeah.
So especially in those border areas, it was much less, much more fluid, from what I recall.
I do not know whether that had anything to do.
So then why just specifically in the South?
I don't think that the Polish Jews had a very positive
influence on... No, they didn't like the Polish.
Jews.
The Germans didn't like the Poles. Yeah. All I'm saying is, you know, when a Kadosh Baruch Hu looks at the Jewish people and says, if you're not going to be no different than my people, then there's no reason for me to keep you around. So what I'm asking is were the from Jews in Shushan or in wherever? Because I can't imagine that there weren't. What about them? What happened to them? What did they do? You know, if everybody was willing to fast, imagine, as soon as Esther said we're going to have a fast, everybody fasted. So, you know, it's this very fluid thing. What were the people really like? Did they go to shul and also go to Ahasuerus' thing? Because
I mean,
it wasn't the way it is today. And today you have frum and non-frum. Then everybody was sort of Shomer Shabbos and Shomer the Rabbanim, but, you know, they also did other things. Like, I think very much of Svardim today. Svardim are like that. They, you know, they dive in the shul, and then they do whatever they do. For better or for worse. Yeah, I'm sorry, Mrs. Walden. Some do, some don't. Even the most irreligious Svardim go to an Orthodox shul.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You look at the Sephardic synagogue here in Detroit, right? Here in West Bloomfield.
Mm-hmm.
So how many of them are there really that are Shomrei Shabbos? Probably, you know, not as many as we'd like. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they also belong to that shul, and their Rab is their Rab. Somehow in Ashkenazi communities, we lost that. All I'm saying is, I don't know, these issues that are coming up today, maybe I'm being too much of an alarmist, I guess. But it gets me really more and more concerned. You see so many similarities. You see so many, you know, you see society really decaying before your eyes. When you have a debate about what is the nature of a marriage, what is a marriage, what is the definition of marriage, and that the president has to get up and say, we have to make it a constitutional amendment, which will never pass, because it's too hard. A constitutional amendment, the marriage between a man and a woman. So if that is the topic of discussion, what is the level of the morality in your society? And then at what point does the Kadosh Baruch Hu say, yeah, it's a land of great chesed, a land of great kindness, but it's also, it's so morally decadent and utterly decaying that I can't support it anymore. And if 90% of the Jews are, which is generous, if 90% of the Jews are going along with it, then what power does the last 10% really have?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
If 90% of the Jews, actually the numbers are higher now, it's not 90. How many, what percentage is Orthodox in this one, in this year's survey? Do you remember? It was higher, it was like 15, wasn't it? 15 or 16%? Identify themselves as Orthodox? I don't remember. What kind of power do we have?
Very little.
Scary. Scary. I think I'm going to speak about this on Shabbos. That's the thing that worries me most about this movie. It's not the movie per se. But it's in today's day and age, we live at a time where communication happens so fast and changes can occur so quickly. We live in a time of accelerated history.
Everything.
Really, everything is faster. Everything is faster. Right? People talk with one another faster. You know, back then, imagine if you wanted to conquer Iraq 100 years ago. How long would it take you to conquer Iraq? To get things over there and to set up and to conquer, it would take you years and years and years. Nowadays, we do it in a week. Everything is faster. Everything is, you know? Yeah.
Do you ever read the New York? I don't know if you ever read the New York Post online.
No.
I like to read Cindy Adams. She's on the comedy. I used to have Ariel up in school. There's an article there. She wrote about how fast people go. It was funny, but it's so true. Instant write, instant call, instant message.
Instant message. Instant everything. Instant messaging. You know, we take advantage of it. Before, if I wanted to tell people about a program that I had, I'm going to have a program this week. So what would I do? I'd have to send them all a letter, send them a note. How long would it take me to write a note? Nowadays, I write one email. I send it to 200 people. I pick up the phone once and calls them all, and I'm done. Instant everything. Okay.
Yeah, but you know, in at every time, there were one or two or three who felt just like you feel now.
Yeah, no.
And they proclaimed it, they made it known.
Good.
Things are coming, things are bad.
See, the problem is, things are not bad now. They're not bad. Not at all. We're sitting here. Yeah. Nobody's harassing us. Nobody's bothering us.
It's too good.
No, I don't even think that. It's good. I don't think it's too good. But I just believe, first of all, in America today, people are way too entrenched. And I also believe that it can go from very, very good to very, very bad very, very quickly. Faster than it was ever possible before. You know, even in Germany, how long did it take in Germany? You knew it was coming, in a sense. You didn't think, you thought it would die down.
It took a long time.
Years, probably 10 years. 10 years.
From 33 to 45, these were the very bad years.
Well, I'm saying, but when did it start? When did Hitler rise, you know, rise in power?
32, I think.
32.
I think so. So
even before it, so 6-7 years. So you watched it happen for 6 or 7 years. I think if we watched something like that happen in America today, I think anybody would, you know...
Well, you know, you wouldn't believe it.
You don't think so?
You would think it goes over.
I don't think so. I don't think it would be a memory that short. I don't think it would... I think that a lot of the people who believe in America today, which I don't believe it, this is America, I'm a full partner in America. I think that... I don't know. Vastiyachadat en ke'inones... Right, the drinking was according to the law without coercion. Kichen yishad hamelech al kol rav beito la'asos kirton ish ra'ish. The king had ordered all the officers' house to do according to every man's pleasure. Kirton ish ra'ish. Does that sound familiar today? Do whatever anybody wants. That's the law. The law is whatever anybody wants. So before, we used to live in a time where whatever the king wanted. If the king pleases, fine. Never switched it and said, during my party... It's going to be whatever anybody else wants. And again, it's interesting. It's interesting. Okay, you said Hamelach. Hamelach is always a reference to two things. It's to the king of Chazor. It's also Hamelach. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. La'asos kirtzon ish va'ish. Right? It was a time of kirtzon ish va'ish. Everybody do whatever they want. We'll see what happens. And unfortunately, that's what happens. Okay. Gambashti Amalkas Damishten Ashim Base Mouse, which Ashim Malkashrios, Rashvi also did at a party. But Yom Hashvi Kitov Le Hamelach Bayayin, when he was already good and drunk. You know, the funny thing is, it takes him 7 days to get drunk. You know, like, what was he like on the third day? I don't know. Amar Le Muhumad, Bizishah, Harbona, Bigta, Abdelgata, Zeza, Rakarkas, Shivasa, Sharishima, Misharishima, Spinner Melach Ashvios. See how it's very verbose? It tells you all the names of these guys. You know, who cares? Well, you need to know these guys' names. Sorry, see here. L'havi es vashti malka lifnei hamelech b'cheter malchus. You should bring her...
Only in the
context. Right, you know the midrash. B'cheter malchus. Right? But even if it wasn't only, it's still a busa. I want to show off my wife. Right? It's interesting. In the Midrash, what is the reason Vashti doesn't want to come? Let's read the pasuk in a second. Vasharina the haros amim hasharin as yafiyaki to Vashti. Look how beautiful she is. Vatimaena malka Vashti lazo b'dvar melech hashem b'yad hasharishim. She wouldn't come. Vayitzov hamelech ba'od v'chamaso ba'arabo. Okay. Now again, think about the amazing allusions, the allegory, right? That the king wants the beautiful queen to come, and the queen doesn't want to come. Okay, again, what's the allegory? Who's the king? Right, and he wants the queen to come. Who's God's queen?
Israel.
Today, Israel. Right? And the queen doesn't want to come. Why not?
No.
I don't want to come? Passionist. I like my party. I'm not a chubit for you. And so does it say, Vayichov ha-melech ma'od v'chamaso ba'arabo.
Very
angry. Right. HaKadosh Baruch Hu invites the Jewish people to come back. I mean, what's stopping them in the times of Achashverosh? Chamaso ba'arabo. And his anger is great. But it's interesting that when did the story of Ezra and Nehemiah happen? It's unclear. But around this time, what happened in the times of Ezra?
People married
intermarried. Well, no. Before you get to Ezra, what is the main story of Ezra? There was a movement called the Return to Zion. Shivat Shiyam, the Jewish people should move back to Israel.
Yeah.
Ezra received permission from the king, from Koresh, the king of Persia. Sure, you want to build the Beis HaMikdash?
Go ahead.
Have fun. He put out a call. How many Jews went back? What do you know?
Not too many.
I think 40,000. Out of how many?
Millions.
Thousands and thousands, millions. 40,000 go back. So, Batana'in Hamalka, right? She didn't want to come. Now, in the Midrash, why does Vashti not want to come?
She has a disease.
No, the Midrash says that she grew a tail. I don't want to get, she had a green, she was green, she grew a tail, But the Midrash is trying to say, I should read you the Midrash, because Rina has a whole thing on this. It's very, very interesting and true. People take the Midrash in literally without really understanding what's going on behind the Midrash. So the Midrash says, Vayavo matatron, an angel came, and he gave her a tail. That Vashti was willing to come, but the angel came and gave her a tail, or turned her green, or gave her tzaras. So there's a number of different versions of the Midrash. What is that Midrash all about? So the answer is, in the Midrash, different angels represent different things. And this particular angel represents Yad Hashem, the hand of God. Now he represents the hand of God in this world. And there are a number of times, for example, where this angel appears in the Midrash, representing the hand of God. And what the Midrash is trying to say isn't that Vashti had a tail. Everybody thinks, oh, Vashti had a tail. What the Midrash is trying to represent is, Vashti doesn't come for one reason only. Why?
Because
the prophet doesn't want her to come. If you think it was just a coincidence that Vashti had, had a stomach flu that day, you're kidding yourself. Vashti doesn't want to come? Doesn't want to come.
So why doesn't Hashem want her to come?
Why?
Set into place all the
right. Because the Yad Hashem, because the hand of God, setting everything in motion. But because Baruch Hu always is, five steps ahead, and is setting up the salvation of the Jewish people. Now, it's interesting, I believe, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts things in motion. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us to save ourselves. God didn't save the Jewish people here. Who saved the Jewish people?
Esther and Mordecai
saved the Jewish people. Right? There's nothing, after Yetzias Mitzrayim, after the desert, after the Bayis Rishon, it's always done through us, through natural means.
But do you think at the end of the Megillah that the Jews understand why this happened to them?
Yes and no. See, here's the problem. Again, I've spoken about this, about Yetzias Mitzrayim, I've spoken about this a number of times. Cataclysmic events never really change people fundamentally. Look at the Six-Day War, right? Cataclysmic event. After the Six-Day War, there was a sea change in the attitude of Israelis, right? Everybody saw the hand of God. It was a wonderful thing. I mean, that's what they say after. It was overt. Nobody ever heard of winning a war in 6 days. Nowadays, we wouldn't take it for granted. But then, some people were becoming more firm again. They were becoming more religious. We got back. So what happened after that? What happened after the Six-Day War? What are the Israeli secular Jews now like? As secular as they ever were. Why? Because the cataclysmic event is only good enough to motivate, for a short amount of time. How do you really change people?
Long term.
Oh, yeah.
Learning.
Long time.
Learning.
See, it is very interesting. As fast as society is today, and this is what's also frightening, as fast as the world moves and as history moves, people don't change any faster. People are the same as they always were. And human nature hasn't changed. I was listening to Mitch Albom, I think it was Friday, and he was complaining. He said, we've overcome poverty. We've overcome, he listed a whole different number of things that we've overcome in society. He said, we haven't been able to overcome people's inability to control their sexual desire. And he was talking specifically about some sports figure who had gotten into some scandal. How come with all the things that society can do, we have technology, how come we can't overcome this? And to me, the answer is quite simple. Poverty and wealth and all these things have nothing to do with human nature.
I just want to say it's not.
Right. It's an advancement in technology, in man's ability. But they don't go to the root of human nature. And human nature hasn't changed. It's still the same. So you ask me, did the Jews change after this?
Well,
the Megillah records a number.
They understand as we do, because you told us, that why they're being punished.
At the time, no. I think history.
And then do they understand why they were saved? Because of, that's
yes
because
and
if
no.
If you don't get it,
they're just going to repeat it.
Just repeat it.
Right.
Look at the Holocaust. Look how many people were tortured to death.
Can I ask you a question? Why did the Holocaust happen? Why did the Holocaust happen?
I have no idea.
Right. So then what?
But
I can tell you, I know some rabbis say it happened because there were non-religious Jews in Europe. And I know some rabbis say it happened because the Jews didn't get along with one another. And then other people think that it happened because the Jews didn't move to Eretz Yisrael. And other people will tell you that happened, you know why? Because the Jews did move to Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So which is right?
No.
When it happens in America, why will it have happened?
You know what they say. I have to say in Yiddish.
Die
Eden lachen sich in die Eden von die Goyim. You know what I mean by that?
No, help me out here.
The Jews throw themselves in the eyes of the Gentiles.
Yes.
With their affluence or with whatever.
Baloney.
No?
Baloney. Nobody ever begrudges Michael Jackson for having a $30 gazillion house in Neverland. Nobody thinks, oh, what a maneuver. He's flouting it in our face. Baloney. We stick it in there. And then Goyim, we flaunt it. You know, where do we spend our money? You know we spend our money? You know how much money that we give in tzedakah, even the non-religious Jews? You know what $35 million is for a community of 100,000 people? It's a sick amount of money, a tremendous amount of money. We flout it in their faces. Go to Hamtramck or something, and you know, go to the east side of Detroit, you know, where Henry Ford, look at Henry Ford's house. He wasn't flaunting it. No, Mr. Henry Ford, he's supposed to be rich. But if a Jew does it, he flaunts into people's face. I don't believe that at all.
No. I mean, if you go to Chicago,
yeah,
for instance, and you see where the rich Jews live,
yeah,
and most of them are owners of old folks' homes and things like
that. What if you see where the rich non-Jews live? And most of them are owners of sausage factories or whatever. How do the non-Jews live? There are many, many more rich non-Jews who live much, much better than those Jews do. Am I right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We're a minority. They can see us quicker than
they see. No, they look at us quicker. Again, I think it has nothing to do with the money. I think it has to do with that. You see, it's interesting. If you have like a splinter, you have a splinter in your foot. And every time you walk, it's in your foot.
It's irritating.
Why? It's just a little piece of wood. You have a whole big body. Somehow you can't move until you get that splinter out. It's a little piece of tiny. In fact, it's so tiny, almost you can't even see it. Right? But it's just driving you crazy. So now, we're that splinter. And that's our job. But everything about us then is an incitement. Everything about us is an affront to who and what people are. No, let me tell you.
I remember
all the situations. Me and I was
like,
oh. Aviva. Okay. So what happens? By Yom HaMelech HaChachamim, Yod Gimel, Yodei Ha'itim, Ki Chein Dvar HaMelech Neko Yodei Das Vedim. So the king said to his experts who knew the times, and he asked his seven ministers, the seven high guys, it's so interesting. He's in charge of everything.
And he asks what to do.
Right. In charge of everything, and he doesn't know what to do. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say, why does Vashti not want to come, according to the Midrash?
I think he told her.
Vashti doesn't want to come, aside from becoming naked.
Yeah.
Vashti doesn't want to come, according to the Midrash, because she is a descendant of a king, if I recall. And he was a stable boy that made good. And she said, I'm going to come for you. The royalty is going to appear before a maneuver like you. And that's why she refuses to come. Which is why it's such an affront to Achashverosh. Okay. She didn't just insult you. He insulted all of us. Because the women, they're going to have women's lib. They're going to say no to their husbands. And she didn't come, so make your own dinner. Did I skip a pasuk? No. And on this day, the princesses of Persia have heard the queen's deed while citing to the king's officials, and there will be much contempt and wrath. We're going to make an immutable law. So why she didn't listen to him? We're going to give it to somebody else better than her. What does it mean when you have to legislate respect between husbands and wives? Mrs. Robert. What does it mean when you have to legislate respect between husbands and wives? What?
Family's breaking up.
It means that there is none.
Yeah, that's very unnatural.
Right. And but he was saying, what Mamukhan said was actually true. If Vashti, the queen, can do this,
anybody
can do it. So we're going to make a law that prevents anyone from doing it. Right? That the wife has to listen to the husband. She's subservient to the husband, and so isn't it fascinating? So that's what Ahasuerus does. They did it. Every man should rule in his own home and speak the language of his own people. By the way, what's unusual there? What's out of place? Yeah, what in the world is that doing there? Any ideas? Anyone?
There shouldn't be any misunderstanding. You should say it so that everybody can understand.
No, but that's not what it's saying. They sent it in each language. But the law was, Ahasuerus says, you must be the head of your household and you must speak your language.
The language of Persia.
No. Kilson Amo. Each his own language. Of his own people.
That's what it is.
Why would he, it's very weird, why would he establish that as a law? Okay, let's do that for a second. Maybe we'll come back to that next week. What does it mean when you have to say that every husband should legislate in his family? So what does it mean? This is like right in the headlines. What does it mean when the president comes out and says, we're going to make a constitutional amendment that marriage is between a man and a woman? What does that tell us? 100 years, 200 years from now, they're going to look back and say, in the year 2002, they made a law that in 2004, they made a law that marriage is between a man and a woman. What does that tell you?
That something went
wrong. Oh. Look back now, 100 to 1930. They made a constitutional amendment, they were prohibiting alcohol. So what does that tell you? It tells you something about the society. Too much drinking. And then what happened when they legalized it, when they repealed prohibition? People were drinking anyway. Isn't that interesting? So you can look at the law, and the law is very often something that tells you about what goes on at a certain time. So here, Ahasuerus, here is on the one hand, isn't it so interesting? Here's the irony and the paradox of Megillas Esther. On the one hand, he's in the middle of a party to celebrate the fact that he's about to become the king of
everything.
I'm the king of everything! I control it all! Ha ha! And then he, at the end of the party, the stamp of the party, the seal of the party is what?
His wife doesn't
do that. I control nothing. Mm-hmm. Not that he controls 127 countries, or 128 countries, or an army, or ministers. He can't even control his own wife, his own house, his own home. So much so that you have to legislate, everybody should be in charge of their own home. By the way, now, what happens in Persia? What happens to the kingdom of Persia soon after Ahasuerus leaves the scene, historically? What happens to Persia?
It disappears.
It crumbles. It is utterly destroyed. Very often we see this. You know?
Who took over?
Who took over? The was it Romans or Greeks? The Greeks, I think. Romans came much later. Right? Very often we find this in history. Basically, this is a story of history. When do nations fall apart? When do countries fall apart? When the moral backbone is gone. When the family structure falls apart. Right? When did the Jewish people fall apart as a kingdom? When they stopped acting appropriately, when they stopped behaving towards one another, when they no longer had any moral backbone, moral fiber. That's a problem today. A very, very big problem. And it should be a cause of concern. Because for better or for worse, there is a group of countries that have moral fiber and moral backbone. And what are they? At least when it comes to family law. What are they? You know?
Would England be one? No.
No way. Every Islamic country.
Cool.
We might not like them. We might not agree with them. But they certainly have family structure and they stand for, you know, traditional moral values. They're not discussing in Uzbekistan what the definition of marriage should be. Nor in Iran.
They know.
Nor in Iraq. Nor in Saudi Arabia or Libya or Kenya or any of these countries. They're not discussing it. Just something to be aware of.
You think Islam will mend this world?
What?
You think Islam will be the...
Oh, I don't know.
But all the countries you just enumerated.
You think that you really think that America is an ideal that people will ultimately want to defend? You can see a great chasm in this country today. You see it becoming more and more strong, more and more stark. Right? The level of rhetoric has become almost so loud that it drowns out any legitimate arguments anymore. Look at politicians today. They don't argue about points. You pick a side and then you just ignore everything the other side says. Right? That's the dialogue today. There's no dialogue. It's just I shout and you shout louder and he shouts louder. Either you are totally liberal or you're totally, totally conservative and you know, never shall they meet. So up to this point, the United States of America has kept it together. Do you think that they always will? Do you think it'll always be so united? So it won't be divided along geographic lines. It could be divided under ideological lines. What is really America? Is it the Judeo-Christian country that we're all comfortable with? Or is it this liberal bastion that allows people to do whatever they want? Who's right? The answer is it has elements of both. But we've become more and more polarized as a society today. And, you know, and each side is more and more vociferous. On the one hand, the right wing wants to impose more and more of its laws. On the other hand, the liberal wing wants to impose more and more of its values on society. So you don't see there could be a possibility that at some point that somebody comes along and says, you know what? I don't want to be a part of that country that tells me that my marriage doesn't mean something. On the other side, I want to be a part of the country that's imposing its will upon me. Not hard to see. And when people no longer believe in the country in which they defend, then they stop defending. Right?
And I don't see it like that.
Well, I hope that...